Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm today's host, Stephen Hausman, an assistant professor of history at the University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Today, I'm very excited to be speaking with Walter Nugent, professor emeritus of history at Notre Dame University. Dr. Nugent has been the author of many books and articles during his distinguished career and is a past president of the Western History Association. We're going to be discussing his latest book, Color Coded: Party Politics in the American West, 1950 to 2016, which came out with the University of Oklahoma Press in 2018. Welcome to the New Books Network, Walter.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Why don't we begin just by hearing a bit about you? What sparked your interest in history, and how did you get involved in history as a profession?
Very good questions. I think always been interested in history, change over time, data, trivia maybe. I started reading pretty early. My mother was a grade school teacher, and in those days, back in the 30s, when either she got married or pregnant, I forget what the law said, they wouldn't let her teach regularly anymore, so she focused her rather intense pedagogical talents on me, and that got me reading early. I don't remember the first book I read, a kid's book of some sort, but I do remember that probably when I was about four, maybe, I dipped into the World Almanac, of all things, and just have been interested in miscellaneous kinds of stuff, and including politics. And later on, became a history major in college and went on to grad school to do a master's in history and then a PhD. I didn't really think I was going to become a professional historian. That seemed to be a little too elevated an aim for me. But yet I thought I'd go into either use history as a preparation for either law or journalism. I like to write too, as well as gather all sorts of facts. So about the second year in grad school, it dawned on me that I could actually do it, go on and get a PhD and become an academic historian. So that's a long answer, I guess, to your question.
And how did you zero in on the history of the American West in particular?
That is sort of accidental. My dissertation, which became my first book, could be construed as a Western topic. It was on the People's Party in Kansas in the 1890s. Kansas is not as far west as California or even Colorado, but it's still west. And I always had some interest in the settlement process, the economics of that region, the Great Plains. And when I was at Indiana University, which I was for over 20 years, from the early 60s to the mid 80s, we had a sequence at the junior-senior level on Western history, and it was taught by Martin Ridge, who was a very close friend of mine, now deceased, unfortunately. Martin got a wonderful offer to become director of research at the Huntington Library in San Marino, California. And he said, why don't you take over this course in Western history? We have plenty of students interested in it. It's got good enrollment, and the subject matter is diverse and fascinating. So I did, and that was about 1980. And I just have stuck with it ever since. I've done other things besides Western history, but that's been my focus pretty much in the last, 20 years or so, 25 years maybe.
It's the kind of place and the kind of topic that just seems to pull people back in. It's hard to escape from.
That's true. It goes all over the place, and maybe I have too, but it's been very enjoyable.
And what brought you to write this book in particular? Why a book specifically about the politics of the West in the 20th and early 21st centuries?
I had done other things on the West in sort of the big picture West. I did a book in the mid-90s called Into the West, which was on the settlement of the West from all sorts of directions, not just from the East, but also from Asia, from Canada, from Mexico, from a lot of other places. So I thought I had covered that pretty well. And then in the first decade of this 21st century, I had discovered in teaching my courses in Western history that there wasn't a single one book that covered the whole of the territorial acquisitions of the United States. So I did that in a book called Habits of Empire, the thesis of which was we've been in an imperialistic country really ever since the American Revolution, if not before that. So that left politics. And there has been, to me, a rather regrettable trend in the American historical profession in recent years to move away from politics and economics, which were the staples when I was back in grad school and in my early career. So, I didn't see anything much on Western politics, the politics of the Western region, especially in the post-World War II period, which is now two-thirds of a century. So I decided my next book was, and this was about 2010, that my next book was going to be on Western politics, and to try to cover the thing and see if there are any patterns. Another thing that led me this way was, like any readers of the daily press or punditry and wherever it comes from, I had been a little bit upset sometimes by writers overgeneralizing and saying, well, the West is conservative, maybe not California, but everything else is very conservative. They began, predicting elections according to that. And I didn't think it was that simple, that the West is a lot more complex. Surely there are parts of it that are conservative, have been for a long time. The stayers of the states that I covered, for example, but not all of it is. And I thought, well, there's room for a book that writes about Western politics and tries to do justice to the nuances, the subtleties, the differences. And that's what I hope Color Coded is about.
Yeah, I found that to be really one of the strengths of the book, was that you really embrace the complexity of this region. And we can talk more about the methodology and the grouping of the states in a bit, but even though you do group some states together, even within those groupings, you talk about, it's more complex than just saying that the Great Plains states were always Republican, for instance, that there are nuances there that you really do explore.
Well, I hope so. Yeah. the Great Plains are... they've sort of been generally conservative, but they still produced a George McGovern, for example, Democratic candidate in 1972 for president. and others. Well, I won't dilate on that yet anyway, but go ahead.
I have one more kind of quick question before we really get into the book, before we really dive in. And that is, I mean, you certainly know that the question of where is the West is a near constant theme in the historiography of this region. So I'm curious how you ended up defining the West as you do in this book.
Okay, glad you asked that. Excuse me. Back in the late, this will seem not particularly relevant, but I think it is. Back in the late 80s, there developed a school of thought called the New Western History. And it captivated a number of people in the profession and well beyond. Books by Patricia Limerick of the University of Colorado, for example, and several other people. And I began to wonder, not too long after these came out and were much talked about, what do people think the West really is? What do historians think it is? What does it include? What does it encompass? What do writers think about it? So I devised a survey with the question, where is the West? And sent this out to about 300 historians, writers, and the Western Writers of America Association, to a few editors of newspapers, and got back a pretty good response. And published, collated all this and published it as an article which appeared in Montana Magazine of Western History in 1992. And to a lot of people, the West is a state of mind. To writers especially, it isn't some place out there except what people think it is. Well, I couldn't deal with that very effectively, but the majority of respondents had geography in mind, some very, very particular. They included the Great Plains, certainly, as well as what the U.S. Census Bureau calls the Western Region, which is the includes the 13 states from roughly the 105th meridian on out. Excuse me. So I use that as a starting point. I in other words, to legitimate the inclusion in color-coded of 19 states, not only the Western Region by census definition, but also the Great Plains states. And that there are six of them from North Dakota on down through Texas. And that's the rationale, really. I thought all of that is the West. Some is more, quote, Western, unquote, than others, some states. But I thought I ought to include all of them. So that's the rationale. Right or wrong, I stand by it.
And you organize the book in a way that I found pretty interesting as well. It's not organized chronologically, but rather state by state, or in some cases by groupings of states. And it's a fairly unique method of organizing organizing the chapters. Can you tell us a little bit about the book's organization and why you chose to use this method in particular? And I did find it to be a pretty effective method as well.
Well, thank you. I had to organize it in some fashion, and just to start chronologically in 1950 and spend page after page on each of these states, it seemed to me to make a pretty disastrous book from the reader's standpoint. It just didn't seem the way to go. What I was doing in order to get a feel for the politics of the West over that long period was to use some data that are pretty much irrefutable, and that is the election returns in these 19 states for the major federal offices, president, governor, well, not governor, state governor, but also U.S. Senator and U.S. House of Representatives. This got me data on about 5,300 elections. The majority of them for the U.S. House, but also the other three offices. And having gathered that, all that information, I said to myself, what's the pattern here? Are there patterns here? State by state or sub-region by sub-region? How does it all sort out? And the patterns began to look pretty clear, that there were some states that stayed pretty much the same in their political orientation, either Republican or Democratic. There were others that shifted, starting in with one party and over time moving to the other major party. And there were some states that were really purple. They were not definitely either Democratic or Republican over time. So that's the basis for the organization. And that gave me states that were that stayed the same, some that shifted, and some that were kind of on the fence. So that's the rationale for the organization.
Well, let's talk about some of those switchers first. Which states have shifted further to the right to become more red over the last 70 years or so? And what explains these shifts? Are there any real commonalities between them?
Okay. There are two cases of blue to red shifts, and it's from solidly Democratic to today solidly Republican. And there are two cases of states that went the other way, that started out pretty solidly Republican and now are pretty solidly Democratic. The shifters are interesting. In each of those two sets, there is one of the giants. There are two huge states in the West from an electoral standpoint, and one is California and the other is Texas. They have more congressional districts, they have and of course a larger population, which creates more congressional districts than any others. The closest, I think, offhand to them would be Washington with 10 representatives now, but that, of course, is pretty small compared to California's 53. Remind me again, what am I supposed to, what's the question?
That's okay. I'm just asking about the states that have shifted more toward the Republican Party over the last century, and if there's anything kind of common between them and what explains these shifts.
Okay. The blue to red include Texas and Oklahoma. Oklahoma being, of course, much the smaller, but it's similar to Texas in a number of ways. I should say this, the shifts of this sort do not happen suddenly. They take place over time. They're gradual kinds of movements within these states. In the cases of Oklahoma and Texas, the economics and the resultant changes in demography, population patterns of those states had a lot to do with it. In both cases, there was a movement away from extractive industry and extractive occupations, farming, minerals, including oil, and to the service sector, manufacturing, and so on. And consequently, a movement from rural to urban. Agriculture is still very important, not only in Oklahoma and Texas, but elsewhere in the Great Plains and elsewhere in the country. But the number of farms has diminished greatly in the last 60, 70 years. Production on each farm and the size of each farm has increased. So we've got, for a lot of the Great Plains states, including Oklahoma and the Great Plains part of Texas, maybe half as many farms with twice the output. That's one change. One factor in the political change. Another is leadership, and this should not be overlooked. In the case of Oklahoma, right around 1960, in a state that had really no functioning Republican Party ever before that, since statehood in 1889, there emerged a leader in the Republican Party who really built it from the ground up. He was financed by an oil man in Tulsa, but Henry Bellman, this man in question, really built the Republican Party in Texas, and it stuck. He himself was elected governor in 1962, and was responsible for the initial parts of this change. A little later on, it solidified the change from Republican to Democratic. Bellman had a lot to do with replacing county chairmen who were doing essentially nothing except keeping a title of Republican county chairman, replacing them with younger people. The average age went down by about half in the few years that he was involved. And this led to gradual election successes for the Oklahoma Republicans until they were about even with the Democrats by the late 80s. Then there's one more factor that came in that was important in Oklahoma and in Texas, and that is the religious right. The buildup of the Christian Coalition, religious right, other such organizations in the 80s had fruition in politics a little bit after that. And in Oklahoma, the crucial time was the election of 1994. There was a decisive shift away from the Democrats to the Republicans in Oklahoma at that time. And the Republicans have managed to keep their hegemony to the present day. In Texas, because it's a much bigger state, similar kinds of things on a much larger scale. The leadership, the demographic and economic shifts, and down the line, the role of right-wing religion. And not only Protestant, not only the Baptist, but conservative Catholics were in on this, were part of it. I would say those were the main factors in the Democratic to Republican shift. It's also a little bit of an oversimplification to say it was a liberal to conservative shift. I think that would be not accurate at all. Democrats in Oklahoma or Texas, who were predominant as of, say, 1950, 1960, were not always liberal. They certainly were not on race issues, although some were. Lyndon Johnson was, but not all by any means. Some of the cultural characteristics of Oklahoma and Texas Democrats as of the 1950s were still visible. Were still visible in Oklahoma, Texas Republicans as of the 1990s or a little bit beyond. So it's complicated. I have one sentence in the book someplace. The changes were not seismic; they were gradual, mm-hmm. and certainly true there. But, similarly, in the shift in California and the other states that shifted from Republican to Democratic, namely Oregon, there were a number of factors. Without getting overly into detail, economic and demographic, the population change in California, which never stopped until very, very recently, it's let up some. In Oregon, the shift in population away from rural areas, away from lumbering, which was extremely important, in the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s, and toward the Portland area and other urban complexes in Oregon, which tended to shift Democratic. There was also in Oregon and in California a movement it began not long after World War, or during World War II, really, of African Americans from the South moving to the West Coast. We think maybe of the Great Migration of African Americans as having gone to New York, especially Harlem, to Chicago, to Detroit, but a lot of it also went west. To the LA area, to the Portland area, and this made a difference in politics. I'll leave it off right at that point. I'm talking too long maybe on that, but go ahead.
Not talking too long at all. That was fascinating. So those are the switchers. Those are the states that have shifted across time, but there's also 10 states in the West that you describe as stayers. And again, understanding that there are, of course, nuances and complications within that title. But 10 states that have remained consistently either Republican or Democratic since 1950. We don't have time to talk about all 10, but can you maybe talk about some of the things that might explain their consistency on both sides of the political divide?
I'd like to, without overgeneralizing, that's the danger in this, especially talking about 10 states. They're each one of them different, but there are some similarities. And to take the ones that have stayed Republican, I think they're, easier to deal with, maybe not. The Great Plains states, north of Oklahoma, which became Republican, has become Republican, I guess I should say. The states north of that, Kansas, Nebraska, the two Dakotas, to the west, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho, and in addition to that, Alaska, leave that out. These have been Republican pretty much throughout the whole period, and certainly in terms of presidential, senatorial, congressional politics, there in each of them, I should point out, there have been pockets, let's say, or areas of political orientation different from the state at large. In Kansas, for example, Wyandotte County, which is Kansas City, Kansas, the Douglas County, which is the University of Kansas, pretty much tended Democratic all the way along. But I should mention one other one because it's interesting in explaining these changes. We're talking about states that stayed okay. Within Kansas, there is a county that didn't stay, that changed. Ellis County, which is in west central Kansas, was the premier Democratic county in Kansas from the 1870s down through the 1950s and maybe a little bit beyond. And now it's just as Republican as its neighbors. Why is that? The answer is, I think, that in its Democratic decades, it was dominated ethnically by German immigrants, so-called Volga Germans, who were German-speaking but came from German-speaking. In religion, they were Catholic, and they were Democrats through and through. I went to college with some of them, in fact, and no doubt about that. But today, I checked this, Ellis County is votes as Republican as its neighbors. And I think it is simply because the not only immigrant generation, but the children and grandchildren of the German immigrants are long gone. And we're now into the fourth, fifth generation, probably sixth. And they tend to behave like people next door in Russell County, almost Republican County, full of Germans, but German Lutherans. So that's one factor. And I didn't measure this in all places where there were immigrants because they had kind of faded out by after the 1950s. Bohemians in Nebraska, for example, and there are a number of other pockets of European immigrants like that. But in general, the Great Plains states have stayed Republican. I think if you need one explanation for it, it is the decline of rural areas or depopulation of rural areas. Again, this thing I mentioned a minute ago about small farms disappearing. There are still plenty of farms, but they tend to be agribusinesses. They're large, much larger farm units than was the case, say, in 1960. Because of mechanization, far fewer people to operate them and make them productive. So the population has decreased in those areas and tended to increase in urban areas in those states. There's one example I pulled out back to Oklahoma for one second. There's a city in north central Oklahoma called Enid, and in a period of a few decades, the rural population of the county of which Enid is the seat was cut declined by half, whereas Enid itself expanded by about half. And had I taken the time to do it, I'm sure I could have found similar examples in Kansas and Nebraska and up in the Dakotas and so on. There are some exceptions that I should point out in covering the stayers. One is Utah. People there will call it the Mormon culture area. The influence of the Mormon church in politics is still very strong. And the birth rate of Mormons in Utah, the birth rate of the state of Utah has been considerably higher than most others nearby anyway. So that's an exception. The conservatism of Utah is explained in part by its loyalty to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Again, it's not right to overgeneralize. Each state has some factor or set of factors which really best explain the persistence, the staying in political terms. Again, I could expand, but you go ahead. That's what you need.
Well, why don't we maybe expand on just one example that can maybe be illustrative of what the book does. Maybe can you explain why Washington State, for instance, has remained consistently Democratic since the middle of the 20th century?
Okay. I should point out, first of all, it is not the deepest blue state there is. It has been pretty consistently blue since the 1940s. And had been somewhat red before that, but still bluish. The leadership, I guess I go to that pretty much first. In both the Democratic and Republican parties in Washington, has been toward the liberal side in both parties. There is a man, he's still alive, he's in his 90s now, Dan Evans, a Republican governor, back around 1970, who was regarded as more liberal on the whole set of issues at the time than the Democratic leadership. So leadership should always be included there. Another thing that sticks in my mind here, I've got to point out, Washington is pretty liberal in its in the area around Seattle and farther north, west of the Cascades. East of the Cascades, it has been consistently conservative and elected conservative members of Congress. You may remember Tom Foley, who was Speaker of the House back in the 80s and 90s. He was successfully elected to the Spokane area for, 30 years. I'm thinking offhand. But when he was defeated in 1994, that was the end of Democratic leadership, really west of, or east of the Cascades. It's too simple to say so, but it almost works out that if an area is dry and it doesn't get much rainfall and tends to be in general kind of flat, then it might be Republican. That's true of Washington east of the Cascades. It's true of Oregon east of the Cascades. It's true of Idaho, although Idaho is pretty hilly in a lot of places. It's true of Kansas, Nebraska, obviously, and much of the Dakotas, eastern Montana and Wyoming. But I don't adduce that as a cause of political orientation. This is kind of a weird thing that pops up. In back to Washington, the arrival of technology, Microsoft preeminently, of other major corporations, Amazon, Boeing, which started in 1916, but became huge in World War II and has remained so. These aren't steel mills. These are technically, maybe not Amazon, but all of it. But they've been a modern, contemporary kind of economic activity, corporate activity, which somehow tends to consonant with liberal orientation in politics. Offhand, I don't know. I'll probably think of other things, but again, the you can't overgeneralize. The Democratic orientation of Washington has been consistent and pretty strong, but not complete, which is also true in Oregon and California.
And you said earlier in regards to Washington State that it's been pretty deeply blue, but has maybe some purple tendencies. And there are five states in the West that are, I guess you could say, varying shades of purple. And these are Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Montana, and New Mexico. And, you know, at the risk one more time of overgeneralizing, maybe you could talk a bit about one of those states and explain why it has been purple for so long. And maybe... You could choose one yourself. I lived in Colorado for a time, so I'm very partial to that state. But if there's one that you find is most elucidatory or interesting, maybe you could just talk a bit about that.
Yeah, Colorado is interesting indeed. It has been reddish more than it is now. It is more purple now, maybe even bluish purple than it has been in a while. I think it's trending in a bluish direction, but it's not there yet. The current campaign for the U.S. senatorship is an interesting one, and the Republican seems to be in a little bit of trouble. It elected the Democratic governor, Polis, this last time, after a few terms as a U.S. Member of the U.S. House. Longer-term history includes a powerful Democrat, Wayne Aspinall, in the West, who was a guy that in the House, the U.S. House, who controlled public works projects, federal public works projects in the West. You didn't get anywhere if you didn't consult with Aspinall back in the 50s and 60s if you wanted to get something done. And very often he'd say, you're not getting it done. He's a Democrat, was a Democrat, but how you classify him on a liberal conservative spectrum is another matter. There are also consistent pockets in Colorado, as I'm sure you know, that are dependably one way or another. Colorado Springs, you're going to find a lot of conservative people. Boulder, not so, quite the opposite. Denver, a mixture. It is a state with a lot of complexity. There are places like, well, take the examples of Colorado Springs and Boulder. They don't change much. If they were states, they'd be classified as stayers, I guess. But they're not states. They're within a larger context, the state of Colorado, and the complexion of the state is sort of on a sharp edge. If some area within the state changes and you don't even expect it to, then the state can change too, and it can swing. It's a kind of a knife edge, and that's, I suppose, what's interesting about the states like Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, and so on. Arizona seems to be leaning blue, but it hasn't gotten there yet. New Mexico is getting pretty close to firmly blue. Montana is getting pretty close to firmly red. They're moving around. I forget what the other one was. That's I think it's one more, but
Nevada, I think, is the other one.
Nevada, yeah. Well, it's moving pretty firmly blue, it seems to me, mm-hmm. at least in the last few years. So, but it takes a sort of small shifts within these states to tip the balance one way or the other, and to having shifted to stay that way, and they don't stay that way, or at least haven't so far, most of them. So that's why I call them shifters.
So looking at the book as a whole, what are the broad takeaways about the politics of the West as you present them in the text? If there's sort of one thing that you hope a reader comes away from this book understanding, what might that be?
I guess it's the complexity of the region. I start in the introduction to it by saying that there have been changes in the last 70 years or so in American politics. Three of them, that regional changes that have been noticed. Two of them especially. The virtual disappearance of so-called liberal Republicans in New England, in the Northeast. That's one. Everybody knows about that. The shift of the South from solidly Democratic to solidly Republican in the 60s and 70s. Everybody knows about that. But not many people know that what's been taking place in the West and within the West, as I have said here quite a few times, I guess, the shifts have been varied within the West, some from red to blue, some from blue to red, some cutting a knife edge or sitting on a knife edge, and the number of other small ones usually staying pretty much the same. So the takeaway is that, yeah, don't, it's what I came to at the very beginning, I guess, and one of the things that motivated me to write the book was that people have overgeneralized about the West. It's not a conservative region, even if you leave out California. It is a complex region, and you don't understand it unless you take a close look.
And one last question. I feel like I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this, since it is just before the South Carolina Democratic right. primary and just before Super Tuesday here in 2020 as we record this interview. How do you see the red-blue divide in the West changing in the coming years, looking at both 2020 and beyond?
I was afraid you'd ask that.
You don't have to prognosticate. I'm not asking for any predictions or anything. It's okay.
Okay. I'll take one example, Texas. The presidential candidates in Texas and people running for other major offices have been, Republicans have been successful in recent years for most of those, in most of those contests, but they haven't been overwhelmingly successful. There have been victories by percentages in the mid-50s, maybe the high-50s, but not landslides at all. And perennially, for, gosh, at least 15 years or so, if you read a very good magazine, Texas Monthly, for example, which has political articles from time to time on Texas politics, what you will see is a sort of eagerness, a sort of longing on the part of pro-democratic writers trying to find reasons for claiming that Texas is just about to go democratic again. But it hasn't happened. And it's a perennial. It just seems to pop up every election. I haven't seen it this year because I haven't looked at Texas closely this year yet. But it looks like Texas is on the verge of electing a Democratic governor or senator or casting its electoral votes for a Democratic presidential candidate. But it ain't happened yet. And as I say, every election, the hopes are up, but it never happens. Elsewhere, California, again, I don't want to get into prognostication. At least I might privately on my dinner table, but not for public consumption. California, of course, voted for Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidate, in 2016 by a margin of 4 million votes, and they've probably come pretty close to that, or maybe even more, whoever is running this time. So you can kind of count on those things, but the switchers, the shifters, I would pay some attention to, and I would really be in difficult and dangerous water if I prognosticated on even Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona. But all I'm claiming to say is, okay, dear reader, here are the trends over time, and here is the evidence. Based on the election returns for all these decades. And I guess you got to read the local newspapers and pay attention to what local people are saying if you're going to try to make a judgment about what's going to happen. Prediction is generally dangerous, and I think in these cases especially so.
And especially if if the switchers are so much kind of balancing on a knife edge as you described that they are, then really it could be any one small thing could shift them from one direction or the other. So prediction, yes, it's a very dangerous business.
That's true. And as we know from the 2016 election, it didn't take too many thousand votes to switch the presidential in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, from the expected winner, Clinton, to mm-hmm. the not expected winner, Trump. Mm-hmm. And this sort of thing could take place in the presidential election in these states as well at this time, 2020.
So I always like to end my interviews by getting a preview of what our guests might be working on next. So this book has been out for a couple years now. Is there something that you've been working on in the interim? Do you have another project that's been taking up some of your time recently?
It's been out about, October of 2018. So, I have several things in mind. I am retired. I haven't been teaching for a number of years now, But something to do with the West, yeah, but I'm just not ready to specify. Wait a while, and maybe you'll see a notice of something. You don't have to buy it, but we'll see if I can get something out. That's the best thing.
Walter Nugent is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Notre Dame. He has written many books and many articles about the American West and is a former president of the Western History Association. His new book is Color-Coded: Party Politics in the American West, 1950 to 2016, which came out in October of 2018 from the University of Oklahoma Press. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Walter.
Thank you very much for having me, Steve. Appreciate it.